This is an ABC podcast.
So do you remember that time when a couple of hostile submarines invaded Sydney Harbour and then fired off some torpedoes and hit the Garden Island Naval Base and destroyed a passenger ferry, killing hundreds of people? You don't? Well, for some reason, it's not something that's well remembered in Australia. But it did actually happen nearly 80 years ago, on the 31st of May in 1942, right in the middle of World War II. That's when a couple of Japanese midget subs slipped into the harbour. The Japanese forces had already attacked Darwin and Broome a few months earlier. But all that was so far away from the big population centres on the East Coast. No one imagined that the Japanese Imperial Navy would be so bold as to sneak into the centre of our biggest metropolis and fire off torpedoes. After the raid, one of the three midget subs disappeared. But in 2006, the wreck of this sub was discovered by some weekend divers. Tim Smith is the Director of Operations at Heritage New South Wales, which manages the site of that sunken submarine. Tim was born long after the incident, but his mum told him the story of how she heard explosions and gunfire on the harbour on that night in 1942 that drove the city into a panic. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Richard. Love to be on your program.
Tell me about what Sydney was like. What do you know of what was going on in Sydney that night before all the trouble started?
Well, it was a pretty average night. It was the end of the week and a bit gloomy and overcast. There was a moon out and the city was just doing what it did. People were coming back and forward from work late. Manly ferries were running. And it was just a regular night on the harbour. A lot of vessels around and obviously a lot of naval warships in the harbour as well. It was a very busy place.
Now, this was after the attack on Pearl Harbour, so the United States was in the war. Were there warships on the harbour that night?
Yeah, a number of warships. So we had HMAS Canberra, one of the large Australian warships, cruiser, but also the heavy cruiser USS Chicago, which had come in from repairs from wartime operations in the Pacific. I mean, a number of armed merchantmen, auxiliary cruisers that were in the harbour, and patrol boats that also they were armed with machine guns and depth charges. So the big ships were the targets, and that's why the Japanese Imperial Navy set their eyes on Sydney, because it was the largest naval port and repair facility left after the fall of Singapore. And then suddenly to have a naval attack force off Sydney that night was quite a surprise to people who were pretty complacent in Sydney at the sort of on the coast at the end of the war, outside of the actual visibility of the war, really.
Yeah, did the average Australian on the street have a sense of imminent threat? Was there a sense that Sydney could have been a target for whatever reason?
I don't think it was really. From conversations with my family and people that were around at the time, there was certainly a lot of activity. There were vessels coming and going. There were troops coming in and out through Sydney. But no conflict was visible. There was, you know, all that was far north, you know, up in Darwin and Broome. And even that was reported on fairly quietly because of wartime sensitivities. So the Australian authorities didn't want to spook people in the Australian cities, and merchant ships were going about their business up and down the coast. There were no convoys requirements at this stage because there had been no submarine activity off the coast until that time, that night.
Tim, what do we know then about the capability of the Japanese Navy? I mean, did we know that they had subs and midget subs that could sneak their way in?
No, that's a really compelling part of the story. And the Japanese were absolutely leading the field in these covert capabilities. There wasn't another navy in the world at the time that had functional midget submarines. In a number of other countries, they were still a concept or in development, but the Japanese Navy had actually started testing these small operating submarines for coastal defence largely in the late 1930s. So at the start of the war, the Japanese Navy had a number of these craft at their disposal. Certainly, they also had a very formidable fleet of battleships and heavy cruisers and cruisers and aircraft carriers that were used for great effect on the Pearl Harbor attack. And the Midget submarines were first deployed on their first combat operation as part of the attack force on Pearl Harbor. So five submarines were deployed there, and then they were next deployed at Sydney 6 months later.
Tell me about the defence emplacements we had there at the Heads, where the Sydney Harbour meets the Pacific Ocean, to detect if any submarines were trying to sneak their way into Sydney Harbour.
Well, I guess the description for those is probably unfinished. because Sydney was such an important port, a big harbour, it's a complex harbour to navigate because of eddies and channels and currents. There was a net that was being built across the harbour entrance as a precaution, but Sydney Harbour being fairly shallow, they didn't really expect ocean-going submarines to make an attack deep into Sydney Harbour, so the net was built more or less across the entrance of the main channels between Watson's Bay and Mosman. But that was unfinished, so there were two big gates in that net that hadn't been built, so there were 400-metre openings that were absolutely passable by Midget submarines, and that's exactly what they did. They headed for those entrances and followed, in the case of the Midget submarine M24, a Manly ferry, allegedly through one of those openings as a guide. And there were some strange things called indicator loops. And these are big wires, big copper wires, insulated wires, that were placed underwater at the entrance to the harbour. And they had an electric current that was passed through them, and that was connected to a little signal hut on shore. So if a metal vessel went over those indicator loops, that metal hull registered an additional signature, and that could be used to signal that something maybe was coming in or out of the harbour. But again, they were unfinished, and only two out of the eight loops that were placed on the seafloor were actually operational at the time.
Had there been any signs in the days leading up to the raid that a raid was coming?
Well, there had actually been a few pointers, and you're looking back now, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But there were a number of clues that something big was afoot. The naval authorities, they'd picked up chatter, radio communications between what they thought were, you know, Japanese warships off the Australian coast. And again, they weren't exactly sure where that might have been, but there was obviously some radio communication between the five carrier submarines as part of the attack force. Also, just a couple of days before the raid, a light aircraft took off from one of the submarines that carried aircraft, and there were two of those, the I-27 and the I-29.
What do you mean by aircraft being launched from submarines?
Well, this is one of the other tricks that the Japanese Navy had up their sleeve. They'd already developed hangars on board the ocean-going long-range submarines to accommodate a folded-up aircraft. And yeah, as I said, two of the five majors, you know, big submarines from the attack force, carried a little single-wing float plane with two floats and two crew. And they can literally wheel them out of the hangars, open the wings, fire them up and take off within, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. It was an amazing technology.
These were seaplanes, in kit form they carried in the subs and would assemble them on the
fully
water.
Functioning.
Wow.
Folded wings, and they opened up their hangars, and they were catapulted off the front decks of these submarines and could fly around, and then they could be recovered alongside the submarine and craned back on board, folded up, and away they went.
Well, let me ask you the question now. If the Japanese are sending reconnaissance seaplanes out and around Sydney Harbour, wasn't that noticed at the time? Didn't people go, oh my goodness, there's a Japanese reconnaissance plane?
That's a little bit unusual. Well, the trick with that was no one expected them, one of the Japanese Navy, to be offshore from Sydney or Newcastle or Wollongong, and they certainly didn't expect them to fly float planes in and do a recce around the harbour. But that's exactly what they did, and you know, the I-29 launched its float plane on the 23rd of May. It flew over Sydney, looked at the warships in the harbour, made some records, and just two nights before the actual raid, the I-21 launched its float plane, and its pilot, Ito, the navigator, flew right around Sydney Harbour twice, and, you know, up to the harbour bridge, and some of the army gun stations around the harbour made a record of a float plane flying around, but they just presumed it was one of the American aircraft from possibly US Chicago. The Chicago had four float planes on its decks, and they just put two and two together, oh, that must be one of ours, and didn't really twig that the Japanese were already in Sydney and flying low over South Head, over the Lighthouse, Macquarie Lighthouse, over Garden Island Naval Base, and making a map of where all the warships were positioned.
That's just blown my mind. When they were ready to press go on the mission and launch the set of midget subs into Sydney Harbour, where did they launch them from? Was it from a ship offshore or a much larger sub?
Yeah, the five carrier submarines actually met several weeks earlier in Truk Lagoon in Micronesia in the middle of the Pacific. And there the three submarines that were going to carry the midgets to Sydney loaded their midgets on the rear deck. They were clamped onto the rear deck. And the five submarines individually went from the Pacific down through Indonesian waters and rendezvoused off Sydney just a couple of nights before the raid. And that led to the attack on the 31st of May when the three midget submarines were deployed off Sydney about eight or 10 kilometres straight off the heads.
Take me inside this submarine. What were conditions like? How many crew did they hold in these midget subs?
Oh, they were tiny craft. They're only really 24 metres in length, and they were only a two-man crew. The crew could only actually stand up in the central conning tower area. It was a very confined space. They could walk up and down the submarine through a very narrow passageway, but it was through banks of 208 batteries and the torpedo room at the front, which held these two Type 97 special torpedoes. And they were a lethal design also. They were specially made smaller torpedoes than the fleets had, but they packed a whopping 350 pounds of TNT in each warhead. So they were big enough to certainly sink a battleship. So very effective weapon systems.
So claustrophobic two-man submarines, each armed with a couple of torpedoes. For the men on board, was it a suicide mission? Was it understood to be a suicide mission?
No, absolutely not. Not in that early part of the war. I guess the interpretation here that is important. The crews certainly wrote letters home before they deployed, when they were sitting on the carrier submarines before they crawled into their midgets, and said they expected to die in the attack. And look, that was more because of the incredible dangers that were ahead of them to get into an enemy harbour that was defended, that had these defences being constructed. It was highly likely that they, even if they were successful, would not recover or might be attacked and sunk in the combat operation. But at the time, they were the elite crew of the Navy. They had all done 3 years, up to 3 years of training in Japan and some active training for their specific chosen mission for over a couple of months prior. So, look, today we'd probably equate them as the SAS, the elite sort of arm of the Army. They were highly technically trained, and for that reason, they were not meant to be dispensable. They were meant to be recovered so they could be redeployed at a later time. Although the midget submarines were never meant to be recovered and brought home to Japan. They were to be sunk after the raid, scuttled. They had demolition charges on board to blow holes in the submarine to sink them, so they could never be captured. But the crews were, in the early part of the war, were actually ordered by Admiral Yamamoto, the Supreme Naval Commander, to be recovered, and that was the orders of the day at that time.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So these Japanese submariners are in this tiny craft that's chugging along with electric engines underwater, heading towards the heads of Sydney Harbour. What orders did they have? What were they looking for to shoot?
Really, the main order was to go for the capital ships, the heavily armed major naval warships in the harbour. So they knew there were at least two or three targets of merit. So that was their mission, to come and attack those and sink them. And you can imagine the impact of that if they had been successful. Vessel like the Canberra, Chicago, heavily armed warship, huge magazines of ammunition for their major guns on board. If they'd sunk and blown up one of those targets in the harbour, it could have taken out the whole city of the explosion from one warship alone. So, and also blocked the harbour from use by having a big ship sunk on the harbour floor. So Pearl Harbour showed that they had very good attack strategies in terms of secrecy and surprise, and they were deploying all of that at Sydney.
So it just makes me wonder, what would have happened if the USS Chicago had been destroyed? The explosion might have taken out part of the CBD and part of the foreshore settlements and the houses and apartments all along there. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and there were also the major ships were anchored around the Garden Island Naval Base, and obviously, these ships are carrying, you know, hundreds and hundreds of crew too, so the human impact would have been very real.
So then there's the first of the subs that got through, past the heads into Sydney Harbour, M27. Was it picked up by those metal detectors you were talking about, those indicator loops? Was its entry seen by the detection systems?
That one, not so readily. One of the things that actually went against the Japanese, even though they had a very calculated attack sequence and mission and they had the technology, they were thwarted by the sea conditions. And what seems to have happened, even though the Midgets were launched by the three carrier subs, you know, off Sydney Heads, they seem to have taken an inordinate amount of time to make, you know, that 8 or 10 kilometre passage. And we don't know if that was because of navigation difficulties. You can imagine these are tiny little submarines with a little periscope not far off the waterline. They didn't have a big field of view. So they were going through choppy seas. They probably had a bit of a southerly swell on them. They were notoriously difficult to control and keep submerged anyway. And it took them a long time to come into the harbour. So even though we think they were deployed around 5:30 or 6 at night in an array, you know, the first one, Midgets 27, didn't make it into the harbour till 8 o'clock. So it took them probably 2 hours of labouring through the ocean to get to the entrance to Sydney Harbour, find their way in through the heads, and then start their attack. But this one actually snuck through, and it didn't get detected or picked up until it was spotted trapped in the net, and that's where the whole mission started unravelling.
How was it spotted by trapped in a net?
Well, again, everybody was just going about their business, but luckily for the defenders of Sydney, there was a night watchman, James Cargill, who was part of the Maritime Services Board, and he was in a little rowboat, and he was charged that night to just be looking after the net that was the anti-submarine net that was under construction. So he spent his night on the harbour and was just going up and down the net just checking things were okay, and then about 8 o'clock, he saw a bit of a wiggle in the net, rode over to it and looked down and went, "Goodness, that's unusual," and saw the shape of a tubular shape underwater with a conning tower, and actually the bow of this submarine that had poked out of the water. You can imagine what was running through his mind at the time. He was, you know, disbelief, and he thought, this is a bit odd, I better report it. So he rowed his rowboat back along the net to the central area where there was a fleet of small craft. They called them the Hollywood Fleet. So they were personal sort of vessels that had been fitted out for naval use, and some of them being armed with depth charges and searchlights and machine guns. And he rowed over to one of these and said, "I think there's something over there in the net." And this was HMAS Yeroma. That vessel followed him down, so he rode all the way back down along the net again, and it's about 8:15 at night by this stage. And they looked at it from a much bigger ship and went, "I think you're right. I think there's something there." So they zip back and try to get a message to the shore facilities to say, "We think there's something in the harbour here. It looks like a submarine." They call it a baby submarine. That was the account in the records. And for some reason, that message took hours to get to the naval commander.
Let's talk about him now. Where was the naval commander that night of the attack?
Well, he was at a party, allegedly. The crews were feverishly trying to work out what this target was down the other end of the harbour, trying to get these messages to Garden Island and the naval establishment to say, look, there's something afoot here, you need to put the harbour on a bit of alert. But there wasn't any particular movement with the Rear Admiral Muirhead Gould and his staff till around about 11 o'clock at night. So we're talking this first midget submarine was spotted just after 8 p.m., but they really didn't organise a considered defence till about, you know, at 11, really, you know, in terms of the naval command. And the message wasn't widely broadcast so that everybody in the harbour knew for some hours later.
So the first sub got spotted then, as you said, the M27 got caught in the net and that had been spotted. What happened to that sub when those patrol boats went out to investigate?
Well, they were trying to get this command authorization to attack the submarine, so they ended up taking things to their own hand and commencing an attack themselves. So Euroma was joined by another small some pleasure craft called the Lolita. Lolita came alongside and immediately dropped two depth charges it did have on its rear deck near the target.
So what happened when those depth charges were dropped?
They didn't go off.
Right.
The depth charges work on the pressure of water, so when they get to a certain preset depth, a fuse will go, a primer, and they'll detonate the main charge. They were dropped in a part of the harbour that's pretty shallow, so around where the net was only really about 20 metres of water, and they dropped these two depth charges with the charge setting too deep, so the hydrostatic pressure valve never went off, they never detonated. So that took up a bit of time. So it was, you know, they were looking at the target, trying to observe what was going on. They could see the submarine, or the crew of the submarine, were actively trying to get out of the net. And two small propellers at the rear of the craft, contra-rotating propellers. What seems to have befallen this submarine is it had tried to sneak through the open western gate of the net. And not far ahead of there was the pile light, the lit timber structure that marked the Western Channel entrance up to Sydney. Maybe they thought they were going to run into that, so they seemed to have probably reversed. And when they reversed into the completed part of the net got the propellers fouled in the linked chain, the stainless steel mesh in the net, and they became hopelessly fouled. They had these surface craft now actively motoring around them on the surface, you know, dropping depth charges. Whether they knew that at the time, we'll never know.
So given that they were stuck in the net and they couldn't get out, what did the crew of the M27 do?
Well, they would have been in a whole lot of deep discussion. You know, they were visibly seen, that they would have known that part of their craft was above the water. There was no way they were going to conceal themselves. These submarine crews were specially trained that if they were detected in a combat operation, they were to sink on the bottom and then drive off at 90 degrees and then sit somewhere for half an hour. That was their way of evading observation or surface craft hunting for them.
But they couldn't do that.
They were hopelessly stuck. They knew they had no option but to remove any evidence of the craft that might have been useful to the Allies. And they had the demolition charges on board. So, look, with all the craft buzzing around on the surface, the two crew, they would have been looking at all of their options. Technical records of the craft when it was recovered showed they'd actually tried to detonate both demolition charges. Now, these were canisters that were both in the forward compartment and one in the rear compartment in the passageway. They were like a small little beer keg full with explosives, about 30 kilograms of Shimozi powder, which is a sort of TNT with detonators. They were wired up to batteries, but they could also be lit by a wick, like a fuse. The rear one never went off, but the front one they did successfully detonate. That's a major explosion inside such a small craft, which instantly killed the two crew and severely damaged the submarine. It basically blew the forward bow section out and ahead of the submarine and destroyed most of the forward part up to the control room.
So what did the Australian boats on the surface see then with this explosion? Did that sort of erupt right onto the surface of the water then?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting and important point, because the Lolita was coming in for another one of its depth charge runs at the time as the submarine detonated its own explosives. And there's some compelling arguments from researchers over the years that it was probably trying to take out the Lolita. They knew they were going to kill themselves. They knew the game was up, and they were probably thinking to take out at least one enemy warship with them, even if it was only a patrol craft. And the Lolita was actually blown out of the water, lifted up on the blast wave from the explosion. No crew were injured in that, but it looks like they were probably trying to have that effect. And you can imagine in that very tense environment, you know, they were counting down minutes. They were looking at all their options. They only had one option left. What were they going to do with those final minutes and opportunities? But the explosion was an enormous one and resonated around the harbour. And it makes you think nowadays, if looking back on that, how many people heard that, and what did that actually mean for the defence of the harbour? It certainly signalled that submarines actually were in. This was no drill. This was not a false alarm, a false sighting. People had actually seen a submarine and now it had blown itself up in the entrance to Sydney Harbour.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feitler.
So, Tim, you said the first Japanese midget sub got caught in a net at the heads of Sydney Harbour, and then the crew detonated their own sub, killing themselves rather than be captured. But then there was a second sub, M24, that slipped into the harbour. How was that sub getting on?
Well, this one actually did trip the indicator loops and those coils that I mentioned that were inside the harbour entrance. So there was a signature reading, and that suggested that 9:48 p.m., another midget submarine had crossed into the harbour, and it was M24. And it was commanded by actually the most junior of the Japanese commanders. That's Katsuhisa Ban, and he had a petty officer aboard, Moro Shibe. Now, Ban was only 23 years old, and he was known to be quite a easy person to talk to, always a jokester, but also very committed and very passionate about his country and his naval role. And you can see that in the tenacity of the way he brought his submarine into the harbour. As I said, it was detected in indicator loops, but not particularly picked up by authorities. He seems to have followed a Manly ferry through the open gate on the Eastern Channel.
So he tailgated behind a Manly ferry.
About 10 o'clock at night. There's some anecdotal reports of people that were on board a ferry that saw it. Periscope behind them in the wake as they went up the harbour from Manly to Circular Quay.
And what was it looking for once it got into the harbour and it was ready to fire at will upon whatever targets it could find?
So they had actually gone right up the harbour to the city without being detected at all. An amazing piece of seamanship and navigation. They weren't sighted again until an hour later, about 11 o'clock. And when they were sighted, guess where they were? Right alongside USS Chicago.
Was the sub spotted from the deck of the US warship?
Yeah, they absolutely were. 10:52 p.m., officers and watch crew aboard Chicago saw the M24's conning tower about 500 metres off their beam. So that is not a good position for a cruiser to be in. And you have to remember, they were not powered up. They were at anchorage at night, reduced crew. The commander, Captain Bodie, was ashore, possibly with Muirhead Gould, the naval commander of Sydney Harbour, at a dinner party. So the ship was in command of the next highest-ranking officer. They made immediate preparations to go into the action stations. And as soon as they saw it was indeed a submarine, they opened up their guns on the M24 right in the centre of Sydney Harbour.
Yeah, it must have been like madness there for a moment if they're firing these huge guns at such close range at the vessel in the water right beside them.
Yeah, absolutely. They were so close that these guns, they couldn't be depressed low enough to hit the target. And so they were shooting off shells that were bouncing off the water and flying up into Taronga Zoo. And one of these shells ricocheted off the water and hit Fort Denison, the Martello Tower that you see in the middle of Sydney Harbour. And there's actually still a chip in the stone on the Martello Tower from a 5-inch shell fired at M24 as this melee was going on. They were firing anti-aircraft machine guns from the cruiser at the target.
Were there Australian ships firing upon them as well?
Well, Chicago opened up on them, so did two Australian warships, the Whyalla Corvette and HMS Geelong. So they were now actively firing at this target as well. And one of the crew on board Chicago allegedly got out his Colt 45 pistol, his handgun. This is Ensign Bruce Simmons, and fired that at the M24. So this is, we're talking like hand-to-hand combat.
I thought that only happened in movies, Tim, where people just, American officers pull out a handgun and go ping, ping, ping.
Pow, pow.
But this actually did happen, did it?
Right in the middle of the harbour.
Right.
And for people in Sydney at the time, they must have been wondering what the heck was going on. By now, the explosion of Tumut's Midget had occurred. There was a huge blast down the entrance to the harbour. Now we're up in the city itself, and there's gunfire, explosions, searchlights, flares, so light up to the harbour's surface. There's a gun battle going on with a midget submarine right in the middle of all this. And they were whipping up white water from the shells from the smaller arm fires all around M24, which immediately dived out of sight. And then it disappeared for another period.
So the M24 that was being fired upon in Sydney Harbour, it had torpedoes. Was it able to fire any of those torpedoes?
Well, they submerged. And the next thing we know, about half an hour later, two torpedoes are seen racing across the surface, actually bouncing across the surface of Sydney Harbour towards USS Chicago. They went alongside Chicago and missed the target. And one of those washed ashore on Garden Island, ran up ashore on some old rope at the end of Garden Island Naval Base at the gun wharf, didn't explode. But the other one went past Chicago under the Cuttable Ferry, which was a depot ferry used for sailors to sleep on at night if they were between ship deployments, and that 350-pound warhead exploded against the seawall underneath the Cuttable and blew the Cuttable out of the water, broke its back, and threw it back into the water and destroyed the harbour ferry. And the impact of that explosion was catastrophic. It killed 21 sailors on board and injured another 10 severely. So it was pandemonium at that stage alongside the naval base at Garden Island. And somewhere out there was a submarine that was now trying to evade and get away from the targets and escape. About an hour later, just before 2 a.m., there was another signature on those indicator loops at the entrance to the harbour saying a target had passed over it on the outward way. So he actually got out of the harbour.
So then in the early hours, a third submarine entered the harbour. How was that progressing?
Well, it came into the entrance to the harbour and it was spotted pretty soon by the HMAS Loriana. They sent an alert to say there was another submarine in the harbour, and the anti-submarine vessel HMAS Yandra came onto the scene. The Yandra was another small craft. It actually attempted to ram the submarine. It was on the surface coming in at the time, but they lost contact until about 11 o'clock and they saw it again and they dropped 6 depth charges on it. So here we go again in the middle of the harbour, 11 o'clock at night, there are 6 depth charges successfully detonating at the entrance to the harbour. Great plumes of water and explosive force at that time, and they lost it. They thought they'd destroyed it. But lo and behold, it had sat on the bottom, so the crew must have been recovering from the damage. They'd obviously hit the bottom hard because when the submarine was recovered, the cage around the torpedo tubes was dented, so possibly hit the ground hard. And they didn't come back up onto the surface till almost 3 a.m. in the morning. And guess what came alongside them? This is almost 3 a.m. They were still struggling to enter the harbour. USS Chicago came charging down the harbour. It had powered up, left its mooring, and was now exiting the harbour in an emergency with the USS Perkins, a destroyer escort, and a number of other vessels. And Chicago almost rammed this midget, struggling still on the surface.
What, by accident, you mean? Just by crashing into it?
Absolute accident. It was racing out, and this one was fumbling to come in, and you know, where the Chicago gave it a glancing blow, there was some suggestions of that.
Was the Chicago just simply just trying to get the hell out of Sydney Harbour before it could be sunk by one of these midgets?
Yeah, the orders were to exit, get up steam, power up the boilers, and that wasn't a small task. That took several hours to get them to readiness.
So in this process of trying to flee from the midget subs, it then goes boom right into it.
almost took it out. So
the second sub escaped through the heads at Sydney Harbour. What about the third sub? How was that faring in its attack?
Well, they actually managed to get through the boom net and got into the harbour, and they were spotted around Robertson's Bay near the area of Taronga Zoo, and then they disappeared again. They were next seen on the same Mosman side of the harbour in Taylor's Bay at about 5 a.m. and daylight was starting to break. So we've got a midget submarine tucked in a very dark cove in Sydney Harbour. And some eyewitness reports from Sydney side has suggested they might have seen a man walking along the outer casing of the submarine looking at the bow. And perhaps that was one of the crew of this midget looking to see what the damage was it has sustained. And we know from later accounts that they actually had fired their torpedoes at a target in Sydney Harbour, but because of the damage to the net guards, they blocked the torpedoes exiting the torpedo tube. So again, there's a warship in Sydney that was very lucky. It had obviously been lined up as a target fired at, but it was an unsuccessful attack.
This is now the third sub that's come into Sydney Harbour. There's been a large explosion from one of the subs. There's been gunfire from USS Chicago. There's been torpedoes fired, ferry destroyed, Garden Island base attacked. Has the whole city been woken up by this? Is there panic? What's going on in the city at this time?
Well, I think there are plenty of people on harbour ferries that were just watching it all as part of their journey home from work in the early hours of the night. But certainly there was enough commotion and the explosions that people, you know, maybe some people thought it was a naval drill or an exercise or a defence exercise, but there were a lot of people that came out to watch, and just reports of people around the headlands observing all this through the middle of the night. And by daybreak, the city knew there had been a major incident. But it was still going on. We're talking 5 a.m. here, and the third midget's only finally been captured on the surface, and it's now under sustained attack by three of these surface craft, the Steady Hour, Sea Mist, and Neuroma. And in all, they dropped something like 19 depth charges from 5 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. after the attack in and around the stricken submarine. Those blasts were enormous. You know, there was no concealing them. There were people living up above, in the streets above this bay, actively watching this activity.
Now, I mentioned your mum right at the start. What did she tell you about this, her experience of this attack?
Well, my mum's 88, and she was a 10-year-old girl at the time, living a bit further around the corner in a unit at Cremorne Point. And they were told very early on in the raid, and it was probably around the 10:30 at night, and they were told by their mother and father to hide under the table in the hallway. And quite amazing, I think my mother or her sister bumped the table and some oranges fell off the table, and apparently that caused great consternation because they thought a shell had come through the house. But no, it was only some oranges.
How was that final midget sub brought down, Tim?
A little craft like that had no hope against massive explosive force of depth charges. You know, these were to be deployed off ships at deep water to sink large ocean-going submarines. Here we've got a 46-ton little submarine was actually seen to be thrown out of the water with one of the early blasts. You can imagine what it was like inside that for the two crew. It would have been horrific. The explosions, the percussion force. We think they probably killed themselves early on in that. They'd actually tried again to fire the demolition charges. That failed, and in the end, the senior officer shot his crewmate in the head and then turned the pistol on himself and committed suicide himself.
What a gruesome end. I mean, these two men in this tiny little sub beneath the water being rung like a bell, I suppose, underwater in these claustrophobic conditions, and they decide to turn their pistols on themselves. It's pretty grim, isn't it?
No other option.
So that was the end of the subs. What about the rear admiral you mentioned? How well had he grasped the nature of this emergency throughout this crisis?
Look, he had been appointed to defend Sydney Harbour and set up the defences. And we're talking, you know, 5 carrier submarines and 3 midgets, so 8 submarines. About 500 Imperial Japanese Navy crew were off Sydney that night. I don't think anyone anticipated that in 1942, that could even happen. Look, I think on that night that everybody was caught out. He was at a dinner party. You know, by the time he came to Garden Island Naval Base, you know, around midnight, Captain Bodie from the Chicago came back on board his craft around, you know, 11:30 in the middle of this gunfight with the midget submarine M24. Yeah, there was a lot of sort of reflection on what could have been done better. And one thing Muirhead Gould did that was highly challenged at the time, but in hindsight, people have given him a lot of respect for it. When the naval forces found that the destroyed submarines, the 2 midget submarines in the harbour, and recovered those and interrogated them, they obviously had to remove the 4 crew that were killed on board those vessels. And they were given a full military funeral with rifle fire salute. And that was done publicly. It was recorded on film at the time, and that information was provided to the Japanese government, and the bodies were actually repatriated, cremated, and sent back on ships, and then connected with a Japanese naval merchant vessel and taken back to Japan in the middle of the war.
Why was that done, do you think?
Well, Muirhead Gould was, one, recognising the valour and courage of these servicemen, and look, it created a lot of havoc and killed, you know, 21 sailors, and the impacts of those families were astounding. But they were doing a mission, as the Allies were doing on the other side, and they were recognised for their bravery. Muirhead Gould also wanted to send a very important message that Australians would look after war dead from all sides respectfully. And they were hoping out of that gesture that any Australian POWs and British POWs and the like would also be treated with respect.
Well, how sad it didn't pan out that way, though. Once they recovered the wrecks of 2 of the subs, what did they find inside?
Well, the ones from Sydney were the most documented in terms of the technology and the fit-out and the engineering capability of the craft. But they also had a lot of small finds in there. There were mementos from the families, Japanese families, to the crew, which they took on board in the final mission with them. You know, there were, you know, hand-woven belts. There were ceremonial swords that were on board. There were bottles of sake.
So what happened to the wrecks once they were discovered?
Well, those 2 were recovered and put on Clark Island in Sydney Harbour, and they took them apart and looked at every aspect of them, from the demolition charges to the technology and the periscopes to the compasses and the radio equipment and the batteries and their serviceability. And so all of that was very rich data.
They must have had trophy value. Were they put on display and toured around Australia during the war?
Yes, they because of the nature of the explosions on those 2 craft, they couldn't have 2 complete submarines on display, so they put bits of the 2 together, and that was actually on display immediately after. That went on the back of a lorry, you know, even down to Melbourne for war bonds schemes, so people were encouraged to contribute money to the defence of Australia through this scheme, and that toured around for a number of months, and then eventually was donated to the War Memorial. It was on outside display for a number of years, and in more recent times brought inside the gallery space and completely refurbed, and is now one of the best displayed composite midget submarines in the world.
Tim, how did this attack affect the psychology of Australians?
Well, I think it certainly rammed home that nowhere now was safe. This was a world war. Every theatre was at risk of being engaged in it. So Sydney was no longer a supply port or a transitioning port for soldiers or a repair port for shipping. It was a target that could be attacked again, perhaps. So I think it really heightened people's awareness that the war was real. It had an ancillary effect in terms of people being worried about their families and their kids, and, you know, quite a few reports of children being sent over the Blue Mountains to schools after the raid. There's anecdotal reports about property price changes in the eastern suburbs.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I did hear that story. Someone once told me a story that it was the Japanese midget sub attack on Sydney Harbour that allowed artists and all sorts of creative people to move into the King's Cross, Potts Point area because the wealthy people of Sydney moved into the upper North Shore to wealthy properties up there instead. And so for the first time, and it's been all too brief, Harbourside Sydney became an affordable, if slightly more dangerous, postcode for people to live in.
Well, look, I think some of that's probably urban folklore, but there was certainly, look, that came out not so much from the three submarines inside the harbour, but two of the submarines involved in the attack, the I-24 that actually launched Midget 24, the one that was found, and one of the carrier submarines, the I-21, they went off, the whole attack force went off and started sinking shipping after that, and they were quite successful. It was the first of four waves of Japanese submarines were then deployed along the eastern coast of Australia up until 1943, and they sank about 19 ships and damaged another 10 as part of those operations that came out of this raid. But those two submarines, when they waited off Sydney for any of the submariners to come back out to their arranged rendezvous, when they knew none of those crews survived, 2 days later, they went on this deployment, and within a week of the raid, the I-24 came and shelled Sydney. So it fired about 10 shells from off South Head into eastern suburbs. Fortunately, most of those didn't explode because they were high explosive armour piercing shells, so they didn't detonate. And I-21 similarly went off Newcastle the same night and fired some shells into what, you know, they thought may have been BHP as a target. And again, that's an interesting insight into the feelings of probably on board the attack force when they knew the three submarines and the six submariners had all been killed in this mission. Some of these carrier support submarines did the parting shot and fired into Sydney and fired into Newcastle and then went off on convoy attacks against merchant shipping.
This doesn't seem to be a well-remembered story. The story of the Japanese submarine attack on Sydney Harbour. Is that what you're finding?
I think it's like all history, unless it's talked about and reflected upon, you know, within a generation and particularly two generations or more, it can become not remembered, not recalled. And I think it's important to recognise what occurred in the past. This was something that happened to Sydney. It was a national and an international event at the time. But it's part of what Sydney is. It's part of that layering of history and memory, a pastime in Sydney's life.
I just have one more thing to ask you, Tim, and it seems a slightly silly question. Were any animals injured at Taronga Park Zoo?
No.
No.
USS Chicago's crew were awfully concerned for the welfare of some animals. actually, some of the crew went round to Taronga Zoo the next day because they thought they must have killed some of the animals.
And just finally, Tim, two of the subs were destroyed and sunk, and the two halves were put together and taken around the country as a kind of a war trophy. But what about the third sub, the M24, the one that successfully attacked Garden Island and HMAS Cuttable and then escaped through the heads back into the Pacific Ocean? What was the final fate of that submarine?
It is one of the enduring mysteries. When M24 and Ban and Ishibe successfully exited from sinking the Cuttable, they got out of the harbour about 2 a.m. This particular midget submarine was told to go north and to rendezvous with its carrier submarine off Broken Bay.
So that's where everyone assumed it had gone, but then it completely disappeared. No one knew what had happened to it for decades.
No one knew where they went. Did they go straight out the heads? Did they go south to a rendezvous? Did they go north? That was missing for all of those years until it was stumbled across by divers back in 2006 off the northern beaches of Sydney, off Newport, Bungan Head. We could then piece that final puzzle together.
What had happened to the crew?
The two crew were almost certainly inside that wreck. They were either overcome by an event inside the craft, either ran out of oxygen or maybe they had some battery fumes, poisonous fumes. They were almost out of electric power by the time they got to that position. The next morning, it would have been daybreak by the time they got up to the northern beaches, they would have known they couldn't have stayed on the surface because they would have been seen by aircraft that was now searching for any submarines off the coast. They couldn't sit on the bottom for another 12 hours to wait for a recovery the next morning. And quite possibly they realised the game was up for them as well and almost certainly used the service revolver to end their lives.
Weren't the bodies discovered in the wreck?
No, we haven't been able to get inside that craft. And for all of those reasons and remembrance and sanctity of the war dead, we have made a management decision not to probe inside the submarine. And that's partly with the wishes of the family of those two men in Japan today, the Japanese and the Australian governments and the New South Wales governments, very respectful of those wishes. The submarine's filled with sand anyway, drift sand that's come through corrosion holes in the hull, and it's highly likely we will never be able to interrogate the interior properly and safely. And we manage it as a war grave, but also as a marker that M24 is the only one of the three midget submarines that attacked Sydney. It's still in its battle context, where it fell in combat on the 1st of June 1942. And the significance of that site is where it sits on the seabed off Sydney, and we manage it with those values in mind.
Tim, it's an amazing story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Online and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Tim Smith is the Director of Operations at Heritage New South Wales, and I spoke to him last year. And since then, Tim's co-hosted a short podcast series on the Japanese sub attack on Sydney Harbour and the discovery of the last of the midget subs. It's called Sydney Under Attack, and you can find it at the Heritage New South Wales website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hello there, Conversations listener. My name is Mark Fennell, and I am the host of... Well, I'm the host of a few things here at the ABC, but the one show I want to talk to you about is called Stuff the British Stole. Yes, that's right. There's a lot of loot in museums and galleries around the world. And if you've ever wandered around and thought to yourself, how did all of this stuff get here? This is the show for you. In each episode, I take one artifact and I trace back its history to how it got to where it sits today. And you'll hear from the people to whom it matters the most. In the new season, you go to South Africa, Ireland, Mauritius, New Zealand and Greece. You can find it now, Stuff the British Stole, on the ABC Listen app or indeed wherever you get your podcasts.